Hello, my name is Rebecca Heinrichs. I'm a senior fellow at Hudson Institute, and today I have the privilege of having a conversation with William M. Bowden, who is the executive director at the Clement Center at the University of Texas at Austin. He is such an interesting writer and friend of mine, but he's interesting, especially to me, because he has a long career also in actually implementing policy as a policymaker for some time at the National Security Council. And so whenever Will writes something, especially something as interesting as the book that he has just written, I read it, and I would encourage our viewers and our listeners to do that as well. And so we're going to chat a little bit about this wonderful book that Will has written for us. And Will, thank you so much for giving us the time today.
Well, thank you, Rebecca. It's great to be with you.
So the first thing I wanted to ask about, so we're going to be talking about the peacemaker, Ronald Reagan, the Cold War, and the world on the brink.
Hold up my coffee too. That's right.
Great. So the my first question, you know, as I read this, as somebody who spends a lot of time at Hudson in my work thinking about deterring major war, and thinking about deterrence, assurance of allies. So when I read something like this, I mean, Ronald Reagan really was the statesman who knew, who figured out how to do that well, lead us peacefully through the Cold War. And so as I read your book, I keep just thinking like there's so much overlap in application for what the United States is going through today versus China. And of course, this growing partnership of actually it's China and Russia. And then they're leveraging rogue actors to their advantage as well. So I wanted to ask you, is this what you were thinking about in your inspiration for writing this book? And if not, what was?
Yeah, no, it's a great question, Rebecca. And I appreciate you highlighting that because I do think there are quite a few applications, insights, takeaways from the Reagan era and our own challenges today, as you highlighted. We can talk about this in a little more detail. But when I first started working on this book, almost 10 years ago now, it was a long process. Those weren't at the forefront of my mind. Rather, I started working on it for two other reasons. One, I've a longtime admirer of President Reagan. I had a general sense that he'd had a very successful foreign policy, but I just wanted to understand more why, right? I just wanted to learn more about it myself, but also wanted, as part of that, wanted to highlight the role of presidential leadership on how a president can be transformative, that, you know, world affairs are not just the product of structural forces, that it wasn't inevitable that the Cold War would continue indefinitely, that a leader like Reagan could come along and make a decisive difference. So that was the first. And the second, because I made a reference to the Cold War, is with the passing of time, now we're some 3.5 decades after the Cold War's peaceful end and the collapse of the Soviet Union and the triumph of freedom and democracy. In some circles, there's a growing sense of, it was all just inevitable. Of course, the world wouldn't be destroyed in a nuclear war. Of course, the Soviet Union would collapse. Of course, the Cold War would end peacefully. How could it have been any other way? Well, it didn't look like that at all at the time. And when Reagan came into office, with his very new strategy for confronting the Soviet Union, for pressuring it, for envisioning that it actually could collapse, but also wanting to do this peacefully, wanting to prevent the Cold War from turning hot, it was extremely controversial. And, much expert opinion, certainly had a lot of, what we would know as the foreign policy establishment, and the academic establishment, were fiercely opposed to him and think this will never work. And so I want to, with this book, recapture how it looked and felt at the time, the challenges that he faced, and remind us that things could have potentially turned out differently or much worse, that the happy ending to the story, the peaceful end of the Cold War, was not inevitable, and it took Reagan's leadership. Along the way, of course, in researching and writing the book, the threat from China that we face now just grew and grew, Russian aggression grew. And so by the time I was finishing the book, it was a strange feeling. And all right, now the world that we are in now in the 21st century does feel a lot more like the world that Reagan confronted. And I do think there are some more direct policy takeaways that I hadn't fully appreciated when I started the book.
I mean, definitely. So it was just providential that you began writing this a decade ago, and then it came out now, because I there are so many important things, I think, that are good to learn and then relearn for some people who are even, busy in the business. One of the things that I'm going to dig right in here, page 109, since you've got the book there in front of you as well. When President Reagan, you had just mentioned, you know, it made a lot of people uncomfortable. So he understood that he was in the business of peace. He was trying to deter a major war, a catastrophic war, a war that involved the most terrifying kinds of weapons, nuclear weapons. And really at the time, you know, America had been enjoying the peace since the Second World War. And so there's a lot of fear about, you know, about Armageddon, about nuclear war. But President Reagan embraced this notion of counterforce.
Yeah.
Can you talk to us a little bit about that?
Yeah. Yeah. So Reagan's nuclear doctrine is very interesting and much more sophisticated, I think, than had fully been appreciated at the time. And he brings a number of different convictions and concerns together on this, right? So first, when he arrives in office, I think he rightly realized that our defense posture had substantially eroded towards the Soviet Union. You know, to put it really bluntly, in the military balance in the Cold War, the Soviets were winning and we were losing. We were falling way behind. Certainly on the conventional force balance, but also on the nuclear force balance, right? So the Soviets had they had more warheads than we did. Their ICBM force was a lot larger than ours. The SS-20s, for arms wonks like yourself, you'll appreciate this. Really devilish three warhead MIRV intermediate range nuclear missile they had deployed were just 8 minutes flight time from almost every European capital, right? And so Reagan comes into office, I think, rightly determined to restore the strategic balance, restore the margin of safety, to bolster America's nuclear arsenal, to deter the Soviets, because he was worried, one, that the Soviets might think they could actually get away with the first strike, but two, that they might feel like their nuclear advantage was so strong that they could win without fighting, that they could engage in nuclear blackmail and just threaten that on us, and that we or our allies would have to capitulate. However, and this gets more to your question about counterforce targeting, Reagan was, there was a, you know, I think, deep humanitarian streak with him that is often not appreciated. He was terrified at the actual prospect of nuclear war, and he was appalled that so much nuclear doctrine, especially mutual assured destruction, was predicated on attacking civilians, on targeting, you know, entire cities of peaceful civilians. He had no desire to even threaten to massacre millions of innocent Soviet civilians, and he certainly didn't want millions of American civilians being put at risk of nuclear incineration. And so that to him exemplified just the horrendous moral stakes in the Cold War, but also the perversity of how that nuclear balance had developed. And that had long been a concern of his, going back decades, way before he becomes president. So once he does become president, he wants to, and we now know this from, you know, just very recently declassified documents on our nuclear posture then, he wants to shift to counter force instead of counter value targeting. He says, look, with the American nuclear arsenal, we don't want to be targeting directly at Soviet civilians, threatening to massacre them. That's wrong. That's what was known as counter value targeting. He says, we want to target it at the Soviet nuclear arsenal itself, counter force. So the beginnings of his shift in our strategic posture are build up our nuclear arsenal to deter the Soviets and change our targeting posture. So we're actually going against their arsenal itself rather than just threatening to, you know, incinerate millions of civilians. Now, nuclear weapons have a very, very big bang, as you know very well. And so it's not like there would be a guarantee of no civilian deaths. But it was a beginning of Reagan's effort to accomplish those two goals of restoring our deterrence, but also bringing a new sense of commitment to human dignity and morality to how this was being done.
Okay, so that was very, very helpful. So I like that though too, of marrying this sort of the principle and that it actually was still effective, that the deterrence was not undermined by actually caring about the morality of how we do targeting. Is very interesting. And then let's just, that's really nice to go right in then to this concept of how President Reagan understood, because even at the time he said it was, he was fiercely opposed by those who thought that it was warmongering, that this arms mm-hmm. buildup was actually going to make things worse, though yeah. that was exactly what he was trying, you know, to actually make things better and to maintain peace. So talk yeah. to us about that, about how he understood this diplomacy and hard power and the threats of military force.
Yeah. And again, this is where there's a lot more strategic sophistication going on with Reagan than I think some of the public caricature had been, because his strategic principles, and I'm going to answer your question more directly there, draw on a number of these different strains. So first, his mantra is peace through strength. And when we hear that, we often focus immediately on the strength part because, yeah, he did want to do a military buildup, but not just a buildup, a modernization. He wanted to restore our deterrence with the nuclear posture there. But he was genuinely committed to peace. And yet, Reagan believed, and I think he was correct in this, that the biggest threat to world peace wasn't the existence of a strong American military or even the American nuclear arsenal. The biggest threat to world peace was the Soviet Union, was Soviet communism. And so therefore, for his ultimate vision of maintaining and restoring peace to the world and even bringing the Cold War to a peaceful end, he needed to first deter the Soviets and let them know that they cannot win a war if they start a hot war, nor could they win without fighting either. That being his big concern, that they would try to gain such a military edge that they could blackmail or coerce us. And so for Reagan, his military buildup and modernization, both conventional forces and nuclear forces, has I want to highlight three main goals. The first one, deter a Soviet attack. We've already talked about that. But the next two get more directly at your question about the role of diplomacy. Second, because he had a comprehensive strategy towards the Soviets, he wanted his military buildup to put tremendous economic and diplomatic pressure on them. He had a line, the Soviets liked the arms race a lot better when they were the only ones running in it, right? He knew that throughout the 70s, as the Soviets were embarked on a massive military buildup of their own, we were slashing our defense budget. And Reagan said, look, that's just nonsense. And he would often say, weakness invites aggression. And we, by making ourselves weak, we are inviting Soviet aggression. But he believed, and we now know he was actually exactly right, but few experts at the time saw this, that the Soviet economy couldn't keep pace in an arms race. And so if the United States restored our economy and started doing our own military buildup, that it would put tremendous economic pressure on the Soviets. But the key part here, too, is Reagan didn't want to just get into a numbers race. He didn't want to, just try to build as many tanks as they had or as many ICBMs as they had. He wanted to leverage American technology and ingenuity and innovation to build, to give us a qualitative edge in our weaponry so that American weapons would be so much better than the Soviet ones, so that even if the Soviets had higher quantities, ours are so much qualitatively better that they couldn't keep up. And that's why my summary of that is his military modernization was designed to outsmart the Soviets as much as outspend or outbuild them. Again, some implications for our contest with China today. But the third purpose, the one that you asked about, is Reagan thought that, and I think he was right, that doing this military modernization would strengthen diplomacy. He saw diplomacy as much more. It's not just that you sit down and talk about things. Yeah, that's a part of it. It's not just talking. It's not just exchanging ideas or negotiating. Rather, diplomacy is wielding all elements of national power, especially military power, so that you can negotiate from a position of strength, so that any threats you make are backed up by the credible threat of force, so that any promises you might make are also backed up by significant military power. Reagan did not want to get in a shooting war. He was very reticent about actually deploying force. He only deploys ground troops in combat once in 8 years, and that's Grenada, relatively small operation that's over in about a week. But his military, and he would often say, I don't want to sit down and negotiate with a Soviet leader until I have, the world's strongest, mightiest military behind me so that I can negotiate from a position of strength. And that will induce the Soviets to get more serious about arms control, about cuts, about reducing their threats against us. And so too often in today's world, we'll say things like, well, we either will have a diplomatic solution or a military solution, or we'll either use diplomatic tools or military tools. even framing it that way, you're wrong. You've lost the argument already, right? Rather, a strong military backs up, reinforces, can integrate with diplomacy, negotiations, diplomatic outreach. And that was, I think, Reagan's really key insight, which, you know, in hindsight, we see he was absolutely correct about.
Absolutely correct. And even now you'll hear criticisms sometimes of things that either the most recent president, President Trump, or current president, President Biden, will do things, and people will see it as provocative if it has something to do either rhetorically with threats or actually with deploying different weapon systems or increasing U.S. deployments, et cetera, that the response is, well, that seems provocative. That seems like you're moving away from the things that are necessary for peace, and that what we really need to do is just talk and negotiate, forgetting sort of that hard power piece.
Yeah. And again, for Reagan, he did not draw that distinction between hard power and soft power. He wanted to wield, like I said, all elements of national power. And it was in this ultimate vision of peace. That's why I titled my book, The Peacemaker. It's not meant ironically or sarcastically. It's meant very sincerely. That's how Reagan saw himself. But again, it is not a formula of peace through surrender. It is a formula of peace through strength. And of peace through, weakening and eventually bringing down the Soviet Union.
Well, let me also then add about this too, because this is really interesting. So it's peace, but it's also the peace through strength is important because it's not peace through surrender. In other words, he didn't want peace at all cost. He wanted peace, principled peace that would be just and would be good for the United States. Talk about that component too, because I think even on that side too today, people think like, well, look, you'll hear both sides of the aisle, for instance, just take one particular horrible thing that's going on in the world with Russia and Ukraine. And when people like to sort of quote, right, it's like, look, if Joe Biden was like Ronald Reagan, he would just negotiate with the Russians and give them Ukraine. Mm-hmm. And that's not the right answer either. So talk about that a little bit, if you would.
Yeah, I mean, so another, I think, summary of what Reagan wanted is he wanted peace through freedom, right? So he was very committed to supporting, protecting American freedom, protecting the freedom of our allies, and frankly, promoting freedom in other countries under tyranny, under communist slavery around the world. And so for him, he was not going to, purchase peace at any price through, surrendering, like I said, surrendering freedom. So again, he's very committed to keeping the Cold War cold. He does not want to get into a nuclear exchange with the Soviets or even the outbreak of a conventional war between the United States and the Soviets in Western Europe or elsewhere. But it's a much more comprehensive strategy of pointing towards that peaceful end through the expansion of freedom. And that's why he was so committed to, as part of his Cold War strategy, supporting political dissidents and religious dissidents, Catholic priests, Protestant pastors, Jewish refuseniks in the Soviet Union behind the Iron Curtain. He wanted them to know that America is on their side as well in their quest for freedom against these tyrannical governments that they're living under. This is why he'll do things like demand the tearing down of the Berlin Wall, which he saw as a horrible affront to freedom. So all the all these efforts, the military buildup, the coercive diplomacy, the support for freedom, these are all in that, with the ultimate goal of peace, but peace on, much more favorable terms for the United States and our security and for the freedom of other people around the world. And he would often use, speak very vividly and bluntly about the horrible oppression that people living under Soviet communism endured. So his vision of peace was certainly not, surrendering them to that sort of oppression.
Wonderful. And the other point that you had just mentioned, the freedom of others and just generally freedom of those who are being threatened by time Soviet tyranny. And today we think about parallels to that as well. And in your book, I had forgotten about, and so I was grateful to be reminded by, in your book, you mentioned Reagan's, another one of his presidential directives, National Security Decision Directive number 32, which talks about the importance of allies. So not even just sort of in a philosophical sense, U.S. leadership in the world, we want, these systems of alliance architectures, but no kidding that he understood allies as force multipliers.
Yes, absolutely. And this is essential to understanding Reagan's overall, I think, very successful Cold War strategy and overall foreign policy. And I want to, and this builds off your question and a previous comment you made, emphasize two types of allies in Reagan's mind, if you will. The first, of course, is our formal treaty allies, you know, the United Kingdom, Canada, West Germany, Japan, South Korea, and others. I'll come back to those in a second. But also, Reagan saw as allies and partners of America as well, anyone in the world who's willing to fight for their freedom against communist oppression and tyranny. And this is where the Reagan Doctrine comes in. So this is why, you know, he supports the Contras in Nicaragua, or the UNITA rebels in Angola fighting against the communist government there, the Mujahideen in Afghanistan fighting against the Soviet invasion. And so when you ask about, you know, Ukraine today, for example, you know, Reagan is dead now. I can't, you know, speak with any specifics on what he might do with today's world. But I do think that support for Ukrainians as they fight for their freedom against Kremlin aggression is very directly a page out of the Reagan playbook of the Reagan Doctrine of we will see anyone in the world who is willing to fight for their freedom as an ally and partner of the United States. But coming back around to that first category of allies, the formal allies, you know, the NATO members, our Asian allies who we have mutual defense treaties with, Reagan saw them as a unique source of American strength. He knew that the Soviet Union didn't have any real allies. It had the coerced vassal states, almost its imperial properties of the Warsaw Pact, right? You know, those occupied countries of Central and Eastern Europe. They weren't real allies in terms of they hadn't voluntarily chosen that the way that our allies had voluntarily chosen to ally with the United States. And he knew that the Kremlin saw it this way as well, which is why the Kremlin spent so much time trying to weaken and divide America from our allies, because the Kremlin was terrified of those alliances and knew that they were a unique American advantage. And this is not just in a nostalgic way of it's nice to see the Allied leaders standing together, getting their photos taken in front of the American flag or something. Reagan saw and ensured that the Allies gave us real material benefits for our national interests. I'll just rattle up a few. Some of the most successful intelligence operations we had in the 1980s were ones done jointly with allies, especially with the British and the French, right? You can find more details on this in the book, but the intelligence cooperation that benefits we get from our allies are tremendous. Burden sharing. Reagan was successful, you know, allies, it's a perpetual and legitimate concern Americans have about when allies free ride, when they don't do their part in funding their own defense. Well, by doubling down on his commitment to them, Reagan also really induced a number of our key allies to dramatically increase their own defense spending. The British do, the West Germans do, and especially the Japanese do. Over 8 years, Reagan gets Japan to triple its defense spending. And this almost opens up a new front in the Cold War, right? It's a revitalized Japanese military puts tremendous pressure on the Soviet Union and the Soviet Far East. We often forget, you can look at a map, just how close Japan is to Russia. Basing rights, Reagan ensures that the Allies are enabling American forces to be based over there so we can project power much, much further forward. And even deployments of our missiles, right? I mean, so the Allies were so trusted and devoted to Reagan that leaders like Margaret Thatcher in the UK or Helmut Kohl, the West German chancellor, they put their own re-election at risk. They were willing to incur tremendous criticism from their own people to deploy American intermediate range nuclear missiles in their countries, because they knew that they needed to do that to deter the Soviet intermediate range nuclear missiles. So we deploy our Pershing 2s and our ground launch cruise missiles. I could give other examples, but the point being, I think the Reagan years are replete with specific concrete examples of the ways that American allies tremendously strengthen the United States and our influence and role in the world. Sure, they can give you headaches. You know, the book has a lot of those too. We had plenty of disagreements. I don't want to be, you know, overly nostalgic about this, but by any rational cost-benefit calculation, Reagan gets a lot more value out of the allies than the cost that we incurred for them.
Wonderful. No, and I was just chatting about this before we started having our more formal conversation here is I think that there's a lot to learn even as the United States looks for opportunities now to use allies cooperatively for their benefit and for our benefit. I'm thinking of AUKUS and the continued work there. And so I think there's a lot, again, a lot of application on the rationale. The reasoning is almost identical. Lots of parallels from then and today.
Yeah, and similarly, I mean, and if you doubt the value of America's alliances to our national security posture today, just ask Xi Jinping, just ask Vladimir Putin. Those two guys see America's allies as a real source of our strength, which is why they're spending a lot of time trying to divide us from our allies too. I hope they don't succeed, but that should also tell us something.
Great point. And I last thing that I would love to hit on that really ties all of this together, I think, really well, is the president's SDI speech. So this is peace through strength, and this is freedom over tyranny, and this is the strength of American ingenuity. All together, I think really tied together really well as we approach, of course, the 40th anniversary of the day that he delivered that. So if you could talk to us about that, that would be wonderful.
Yeah, sure. And it's the speech. I would encourage our viewers to go back and either watch on YouTube or reread the text of the full speech itself. You know, this month is the 40th anniversary of it, of course. And in some ways, it reads just as fresh and interesting now as and innovative now, frankly, as it was then. So for the context, we've talked earlier in our discussion here about the different pillars of Reagan's defense buildup and modernization, his goal of restoring American deterrence, of peace through strength, of emboldening our diplomacy so that we can negotiate from a position of strength. And all this designed to counter and neutralize any advantages the Soviets had developed. And the culmination of this, of course, is Reagan's Strategic Defense Initiative, quick summary, was his visionary and far-fetched notion of building a multi-layered shield against ballistic missile attack. And there's a few different strains that go into how and why he comes around to this. The first is, as I said, it culminates his vision of using American technology and ingenuity to not just counter any Soviet advantages on the military balance, but actually neutralize them and make them obsolete. So at the time, the Soviets had a tremendous advantage in the number and range of their ICBMs over ours. You know, I can't remember the exact numbers right now, but the SS-18, you know, the leading Soviet ICBM had like 10 MIRV warheads, and they had maybe twice as many of them as the United States did. And Reagan did not just want to therefore go out and build an equal number of American ICBMs. You know, our new one at the time was the MX. He thought, what if we can actually come up with a next generation technology that renders those SS-18s obsolete, so that no matter how many the Soviets launch at us, none of them will get through, right? Again, it sounds fantastical, and it was rather fantastical, but he hoped that with that, we would show the Soviets, no matter how many more rubles you are throwing at your SS-18s or whatever other new generation of long-range, of ICBMs you're building, they won't get through. Right? We'll turn it into an obsolete technology. So that's the first part of, yes, it is part of his, you know, defense strategy to restore the American edge in the military balance. But this the second part of it is he wanted to fundamentally change the entire strategic balance in the Cold War, which had been predicated on that balance of terror, on mutual vulnerability, mutual assured destruction. And he had said, look, thus far, the arms race in the Cold War has been outracing each other on offensive weapons. Let's see who can do more to kill more of the other side's people. What if instead of pursuing that strategy of destruction and vengeance, we flip it where it's now an arms race to strengthen our defensive postures, and we compete to see who can save more lives, right? Who can protect our people better? And Reagan had this wonderful way of taking a fairly complicated concept like that and put it in simple language, like, you know, we're racing to see who can defend more lives and protect more people. But his ultimate vision was he wanted to see all nuclear weapons eliminated, right? I mean, he's a very visionary, that it's all, you know, a dream he has. He's terrified of these weapons. He was not just going to unilaterally disarm. He's very critical of, you know, calls for a nuclear freeze or anything. But his hope is to make all these weapons so obsolete through this missile shield that we can just get rid of all of them from the face of the earth. He is really terrified of them. But he's very clear on the sequencing. You first need to get rid of the Soviet Union itself, which is the biggest threat to world peace. And then he hopes along the way you can get rid of nuclear weapons. Reagan was realistic enough to know that, look, building a missile shield like this isn't going to happen next year, even though the United States has tremendous technological resources and innovation and, you know, anything we put our mind to, we can. You know, we put a man on the moon 15 years earlier, you know, 14 years earlier when he's given the speech. He has a line at one point, he says, look, when someone first came up with the idea of a submarine, we were skeptical of it, but now, you know, we're the world's leaders in submarines. But he wanted at least sketch a vision, set a vision out there, even if it would be, you know, potentially decades before SDI would become operational. And of course, many skeptics tutted this and said this will never work. But Mikhail Gorbachev, who becomes a Soviet leader, he worried that it could work. He was terrified of this. And we now know that SDI became absolutely essential to strengthening Reagan's diplomacy in pressuring the Soviet Union and getting it to agree to eliminate all of its intermediate range nuclear missiles in the INF Treaty, and eventually to the system's own collapse. And then look, I think, you know, you're much more of a technical expert on missile defense than I am, but I think we can trace now the missile defense systems we do have, and partners like Israel do have, and we're sharing some of these with the Ukrainians. Their intellectual birth, of course, goes back to the Reagan era, and when he starts this research program for SDI, and even if the full-fledged SDI doesn't become operational, it certainly leads to a number of, I think, very helpful, you know, the Patriot, for example, systems which we have now.
No, I think it's absolutely true that even the concept and thinking about it from a position of strategy, that having defenses actually also bolsters the credibility of your deterrence, because you're demonstrating, you know, that you're willing to point these weapon systems at the bad guys, but you're also willing to defend. And so it bolsters the credibility that you're willing to use these and defend your own people. So I think it strengthens deterrence. And from a technical perspective, absolutely. A lot of the technology that sort of came out of this idea of the president's vision, it has been applied to the homeland missile defense system that we have today. And of course, it's my hope that we would continue to build on that research and technology. And really, so many decades after the president gave that speech, the technology has actually moved forward in a lot of ways, even if for different applications. And so his vision could be even closer to being realized, I think, today than maybe he even had the ability to make it come true at his time. But certainly we've been great beneficiaries of both the policy, the vision, the aims, and then also the technical innovation that happened because of his vision.
Yes, absolutely.
Well, thank you so much. This has been absolutely a delight. I would love to continue chatting about everything else that's in your book. I would once again encourage those watching from home to go out and buy the book. Not only will you learn some things or be reminded of things, I certainly continue every single page. I was learning more and being inspired for different ideas and how to think about the U.S. role in the world today, what is possible, not to get discouraged, and to know that it does take great statesmanship to make things happen, but it can be done. The United States has done this before. And so it's very encouraging, very thankful that you spent a decade working so hard on the scholarship to bring us this book. Thank you so much, Will.
Well, thank you, Rebecca. It's been a great pleasure, and very grateful for your kind words, and certainly enjoyed the discussion too.